Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to this edition of Fire Talk, Stage Left. I am David Little Eagle, your host for the evening, with my co-host and producer, Nell Cole. For those of you who have been through many experiences, painful, sorrowful, and are having a hard time expressing your story and telling of your life's experiences. On the show tonight, we have two extraordinary women. One who has been with us before is the author of two books, Can You Hear Me Now? And Can You Hear Me Now? Part 2. And it is with great pleasure that I introduce to you again Annie O'Sullivan. And with us also is Mary Beth Egling. And they are going to guide you in a process which I believe is extremely helpful for those who want to go out and say, hey, this is what happened to me, and to put it down on page so that others can read and find hope. Welcome to the show, Annie, and welcome to the show, Mary Beth.
Hi, David.
Hi, David. Hi, Nell.
How are you? All right. We have a very, very interesting topic tonight because a lot of people probably don't believe well, I'm not a writer. I don't know how to do this, but you're here to help our listeners, anybody who wants to get their stories down on page, and I'm going to turn the reins over to you wonderful, wonderful ladies this evening to share your information with us. How about that?
Sounds great. Now, would you like to go first, Danny?
I was just going to say, would you like to go first, Mary?
just to give the listeners a little background on myself, I've published two books. One was self-published and one was conventionally published. And through the process of publishing two books on either side of the continuum, I put together an introduction to publishing course to help people get their work into print.
And Anna, you want to tell us about yourself?
Oh, sure. I've got two books published. It's actually a trilogy, so there's still a third one. I'm conventionally published through I Read, I Write Publishing, which is in Canada. I don't know, you want to hear how I started writing or?
We'll go into that in a little bit, but let's just start first by, Annie, would you give your web page so people know how to contact you? And then we'll do the
same
with Mary Beth.
My website is www.writersportal.org/ Can You Hear Me Now? And you can find me on Facebook under Annie O'Sullivan 2009.
All right, great. And Mary Beth, did you give your contact information?
Sure. My website is www.mbegeling.com, and you can find me on Facebook at mbegeling, my last name.
All right, great. So what I'd like to do, since the show has so much content in it, is I'd like to begin, and let's just get the process started. So I think the best place to start, Mary Beth, if you would, is describe some of the things that's necessary before you even write a book, informing the ideas and what people may need to think about if they're going to write their book.
Well, you know, I think that most people have a sense, how many times have we heard, I should write a book? I think almost everybody we know has said this. And I think that is, if you kind of liken that to some type of inception of an idea. And some people take that idea and they do absolutely nothing with it for the rest of their lives rather than talk about, I should write a book. But there are people who make the decision that not only should I write a book, but I am going to write a book. And I think sometimes just the simple thought of going from I should to I will get you on the road. I don't know if you'd agree with that, Annie, or not.
Oh, I would absolutely agree with that. I was kind of driven once I decided I was doing it.
Yeah, sometimes just making the decision puts you on the road to having it come to fruition.
Right. And then what after you've decided that you have something that you want to share with people, then what's the next step that people should understand before taking this on?
Well, I think from a standpoint of just getting some ideas put down on paper and, you know, if you become overwhelmed with how am I going to market this book, how am I going to publish this book, I think that's putting the cart way before the horse. I think just sitting down in an environment with no distraction, just start jotting some ideas down is a start, and then it gives you a skeleton from which to build on, you know, your chapter, your story, or your entire trilogy. For example, you can get it as big as you want it to be, but you actually have to put pen to paper and you have to start writing words down.
So do you think it's important before people even think about publishing or any of that to take some time and write and see how it feels and flows?
I do.
And get a little bit of structure?
A couple of the people who have taken my course have actually come with their manuscript to class, and they realize that after they've written the manuscript, they have no intention of having it published. Just the fact that they went through and wrote something really help them out. Other people come with a manuscript and say, yes, I'm going to publish. So I think the first step is getting something concrete that you can hold in your hand, no matter how raw or how polished it is, and then take that to the next step, whatever step seems to be logical at that point.
Oh, I need to say something there, because that comment you made about no matter how raw it is, I talk to people who think that you just magically sit down and you put together this manuscript and that you have magical knowledge, and that does not happen. So,
no, you're absolutely right. And do you know,
you write
I had
it, rewrite it.
And over again, and I had a musician tell me once that writing a book must be like composing something, because you hate it before you love it. You get to the point where you've read it so much, you've worked on it so much, you just can't stand to look at it anymore. And then shortly after that point, all the clarity and all the beauty comes through, no matter how, no matter what the subject matter might be.
Yeah, I would agree.
So what do you think causes people to stop in the middle of it and get overwhelmed?
Writing is not fun. It's hard work. There's seemingly no immediate gratification from sitting down and taking yourself all the possibly fun things you can do in your life and actually physically laboring over which word is right for the sentence or how am I going to bring this thought across. It is. I love to write, but it is not fun.
Did you have the same thing?
Yeah, I was writing today. I rewrote the same paragraph for about an hour and a half. And then I got rid of it altogether.
That's not most people's idea of how they'd like to spend an hour and a half. And I find a lot of writers who begin writing for the first time, they engage in something called constructive avoidance. They sit down in front of their computer and they say, oh, I have to do a load of laundry. And then they'll sit back down and they say, oh, the cat has to be fed. So they're not wasting time, but they are constructively avoiding what they really should be doing at that moment, which is putting some words on paper.
Right.
And that's a very difficult thing to get around, I think, for myself, I mean, a lot of people.
So it requires a certain amount of dedication.
It does.
If you're really going to make it happen.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, and maybe Annie would agree, but I think habit also has a lot to do with it, because if you sit down once a month and try and write, you're unhabituated in how you approach your computer, what you do to prepare. But if you find yourself getting in an every other day or even an everyday habit, even for just 10 minutes, your brain begins to wire itself that way to actually begin to look forward to the activity rather than dreading it.
Oh, right. You know what? I think you're right, because I try to make myself sit at least an hour every day. And sometimes I don't do anything, and then sometimes I sit there for 3 hours because it's working. But I make myself sit there.
Right, and sometimes if you hadn't sat down and cleared your mind and gotten all the distractions out of your life at that moment, you might not have gotten those thoughts that came to you because you did just that. At least that's how the process works for me and many of the people that have taken my class.
So go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I do know something that happens to me, and it might be because of the subject material, is sometimes, you know, I'll write and write and write, and I'll get all this stuff down, and I have to step away from it for a couple of weeks and then go back and look at it. I kind of lose my objectivity sometimes.
Well, the good thing is you can step away from something concrete. You know, and I always say you're better looking at it than looking for it. You're better off having words on paper that you can, either because it's upsetting or because you've just had enough of it, walk away from it, because when you come back, it's waiting for you, however long it takes you or however quickly you return to it. So I think we're all kind of saying the same thing. You've got to get words on paper. No matter how you do it, you have to start the process. Assuming that you know how it's going to turn out in the end.
So how important is having an environment that's quiet and not where people aren't interfering and to be able to be that creative?
I can only speak for myself and you know, the people that I've helped, but I think that any electronic intrusion. And here we are on blog radio, but any electronic intrusion really
other than blog radio
removed from the equation. I mean, you can't be typing a document on your computer and have your Facebook open, or have your email, and then you see this little, you know, your little noise comes in and you have mail. You really do have to discipline yourself to extract your person from all
right.
of the things that have a tendency to distract us, and there's a lot of them, unfortunately.
Yes, they're definitely.
Oh, they're endless.
They are endless.
And
I
have to turn off. I turn off the TV. You know, if
sure.
I hear the neighbors outside, I kind of cue into that. But you know, and I live alone, so I don't have a lot of distractions.
Mm.
But she's right. You can't have all that going on.
Yeah, and I always tell myself I have control over my environment, because so many times we think we don't. Our phone rings and we say, oh, I have to get that, or the doorbell rings and I have to answer it. But, you know, really when you look at it objectively, everybody has complete control over
uh-huh.
most distractions in their environment. And I think sometimes just giving yourself permission to say this writing time is not just important, it's critical, treating it like something that has a very high priority, then some of the distractions have a tendency to fall away for you.
That makes perfect sense. And so it's not something you're just doing on the side, like a leisurely activity. It's something that requires devotion and a high priority.
That's right. You know, when I teach the class, I tell people, pretend you're the little old lady who has got to watch her soap opera at 7 o'clock. They will rush to the supermarket, get everything done so that they can sit down in front of the television and see the soap opera that they've been watching for 30 years. This was my grandmother. She had to watch it at 7 o'clock. So
yeah.
that mm-hmm. sense of priority actually helps you get it done, because nothing was going to stop her from watching The Young and the Restless.
Oh,
and
yeah,
if you treat your writing
funny.
That way, I think that that helps you carve out that time that is really important to do it.
You know, I think you're right. For obvious reasons, I think you're right. But I didn't think about it until just now that I have friends who will call on the weekend, because
mm-hmm.
I have a day job, and they'll ask me, are you writing? Because if I say yes, they won't talk to me.
So they respect how you have made that a priority in your life, and that's your job to tell everybody else, I'm writing. People don't accidentally know that. They just you probably have given that impression, I'm writing now, I can't do this. People can give themselves the same permission to really be protective of the time that they spend writing their story.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And people respect it. Yeah, you're right. I mean, nobody's ever said, oh, man, I have to talk to you right now.
No, it's almost as sacred as the baby sleeping, I can't talk right now. You know, they give you wide berth, and they completely understand, because it is one of those things that intuitively people get the fact that you need to concentrate without even maybe having even written before. They just know
right.
that you need time to concentrate.
Oh, and they want you to succeed. Your friends want
yeah.
you to succeed.
Absolutely.
Now, what if you have an amazing story, but your writing skills aren't that good? What is it that you could tell people to help bridge that gap?
Well, you know, there's two main options for people. One is hiring a ghostwriter. But the ghostwriter is just what it sounds like. There's somebody else writing the story that you tell, and that has a tendency to be a little less personal. The way I recommend people who come to me and say, I don't have really good writing skills, I tell them, write your story down and see another writer for something called manuscript enrichment. They can sit with you and maybe suggest that you make the sentence a little bit longer, add some descriptive words in, because really the basic thoughts are yours and they belong to you. And if once you get them down on paper, any talented person could help you, you know, fatten that up a little bit. That's why I prefer the manuscript enrichment over the ghostwriting. I don't know if you've done that for Annie, for people, or if you've heard of either situation with people you've been in contact with.
No, but what a marvelous suggestion, because I hear from people on just about a weekly basis lately that they would like me to co-author their book, and I haven't really known how to respond to that.
Well, you can say, I can help you enrich your manuscript, which is what I tell people.
I love that.
And then when you do that, you don't become privy to the copyright. You basically have helped them, and any suggestions that you make, they have final decision over, and then they own the entire content of the book because it really was theirs, where if you co-author it, obviously you are one of the authors of the book.
Well, and my concern there, particularly with the stuff I write about, is I don't want it to inadvertently turn into my story.
Exactly. And that's the danger of a ghostwriter, because they will take facts, dates, figures, persons, and then go through their own descriptions. It does become someone else's story, even though you told them the story. Where manuscript is Richmond is, you can have a very simple, even a paragraph, and an accomplished writer or anybody in the business can help that person make the best paragraph ever. And what you can do for a paragraph, you can do for a chapter, and you can do for a book.
Nice.
So there
very
are
nice.
Options for people who maybe have rudimentary writing skills. It shouldn't limit you from telling your story.
Wow. I like that so much, I wrote it down. I just did.
That's all about, ladies.
A marvelous concept.
That's right.
Dave, is there anything you wanted to add at this point before we continue?
Well, there's something, I mean, there's a big difference between, for example, fiction writing and the type of writing that we're talking about tonight. Now, there are two books that I came upon in the library, and yes, I want you to laugh. I want you to laugh, because you gotta laugh sometimes. There was a book by you ready? There was
yeah.
a book by George W. Bush and
really?
Sarah Palin. Now,
yeah.
And who?
Now it says that they wrote it, but you know what? I doubt it.
I don't believe
a second that Sarah Palin can spell her name without a misspell and forget about George W. Now, the manuscript in Richmond is a great idea, but there's a different spirit, a different feel to the type of literature that we're talking about here, ladies and gentlemen. I wanna go back for a minute to Annie. Annie, you were on Stage Left about 2 weeks ago, was it now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Something like 2 weeks. Annie, when you read excerpts from your book, holy cow, Nell mm-hmm. and I, and we discussed this afterward, that when you were reading, we were there with you.
Absolutely.
And to anybody out there listening to this show and listening to these extraordinary women on this show tonight, folks, when Annie told her story, it brought tears to my eyes, but it gave me such hope for people out there who are suffering. So, you know what? There's a big difference between fiction. You don't want your story to be a Hollywood version of truth. And with that in mind, I just want to say that this is a very important topic for our listeners tonight, because there are a lot of people out there listening to you, and we can laugh at Sarah Palin and we can laugh at George W. Bush, but ladies and gentlemen, Annie O'Sullivan is a warrior survivor, and when she told her story, it moved people. And I believe that anybody with a story to tell of the experiences of their lives that can bring hope to others, this is a great show to tune into. So I just want to take a second to thank you, ladies, and thank you so much. And please continue. I am going to enjoy this.
You're welcome. That's a great testament
to you,
Annie. Congratulations.
Yeah. Annie, in that moment of what David just said, when you have to write about topics that are a lot heavier than the normal mainstream topics, such as child abuse, Do you find that it's a whole different piece of the process of writing a book?
I'm not sure what you want. What you want me to answer now?
Well, I mean, there's one thing to write, like a story of something you care about. It's another when you have to revisit old memories that have been hidden, and it's a whole therapeutic process more than just writing a book. It's especially for a lot of people who haven't spoken their truth. So,
right.
What kind of circumstances are things that could people encounter when writing their own personal story if it's a tragic one?
Well, you know, obviously at this point I've talked to several people that
yeah.
have written their stories, and it's a little different for everyone, I think. I think it depends on where you're at. I know someone that has actually gotten her book published through Random House.
Mm-hmm.
Her therapy was writing her book. I know somebody who's going through therapy and writing their book. My own experience was I went through 10 years of therapy and then 10 years of trying to write a book. It took me a long time to find my voice. But what has happened for me was not so much discovery. I started writing because I was still angry. And I thought, you know, I've got a big mouth and I've got something to say. What has happened to me over the last 2-3 years is I discovered it was a responsibility to tell it right. And by telling it right has been very freeing to me. You know, I mean, I just don't carry around one extra pound of anything in my head anymore because it's pretty much out there. Everybody knows, and I believe that I told it honestly. You know, it's honest. And I hope I'm answering your question because I'm feeling
you're
like I'm a little all over
it.
The place with
no,
it.
No, you're exactly answering what I was asking because
you know,
it is a very hard process. I have a lot of survivors in my network that I would love for them to empower themselves by writing their story. And that's
absolutely.
The main reason why I put this show together is to hopefully give them the courage to do that.
Yeah, they don't, you know, they don't need to feel guilty. They don't need to feel ashamed. They don't need to feel, you know, like they're not important. These stories are really important for other people. I had no idea the impact that this was going to have on the survivor community. I had no idea. It's very humbling, to say the least. And I want a whole bunch of people out there to feel humble with me. So.
Absolutely. All right. So, Mary Beth, as far
yes.
as after you've written it, what is the next phase, the editing process? What is it that people need to understand about that piece of it?
Well, I think at this point it's probably helpful to have a little bit of understanding of the different ways you can publish a book because that will determine what you do next.
Okay.
If you're going to send your manuscript or work with an agent to go to a conventional publisher, it has to be in absolute tip-top shape before it gets there. If you're going to be publishing, self-publishing, having it be in relatively good shape is important, but it's going to go through a number of edits anyway. And if you're going to publish by what's something called an undedicated publishing, like a local a print shop, you have to make sure it's in tip-top shape because they're not going to do any copy editing for you. So depending on, you have to begin to think about which way you'd like to go with publishing your work. That will determine the steps you take next.
Good advice.
Which one is the cheapest way to get your book from written to published?
Well, the cheapest way is the undedicated publishing, which basically means you don't go through copyright registration, you don't get an ISBN number and a barcode assigned to your book. You take your manuscript to a local printer with binding capabilities and you say, I'd like to have this be my cover, I'd like this to be my back matter, and I'd like you to print and bind it, and I'd like 100 copies, please. That's the fastest way to get your book published. There are circumstances where that's appropriate, but for maybe survivor stories, maybe you want to go to the next level, at least have a copyright and an ISBN so that it can be sold on distribution channels like Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Right.
Ooh. Right. See, I had gotten my copyright,
mm-hmm.
but my publisher did everything else for me.
Right. And probably what would have happened, too, I find out with my second book with conventional publishing, I had done the same thing, Annie. I got my copyright, and then come to find out they would have done the copyright as well in a lot quicker than I was able to get it, because publishing companies purchase copyright numbers in lots, so they have them to hand out right away, where when you're a single person sending off your manuscript to have a copyright,
oh.
you get in line with everybody else in the government, you know, waiting to have the number issued to you.
Oh, yeah, because it went, and I kind of wondered if it got lost in the mail.
Yeah. Mine took 6 months, and when I published my first book with the self-publisher, I had a copyright registration and ISBN in 3 days. So that
wow.
between trying to do it yourself, which is possible, or just letting you know somebody else take care of that who does it all the time, because they just grab the numbers off the shelf and they assign it to your title.
Wow, all this is such great information to have. What about contracts? How do they play into this?
Do you want me to go, Annie, or would you like to?
Well, it's probably quicker for me to just, because I don't have a lot.
Go right
but
ahead.
I actually have two different contracts. I have one for the online digital Kindle type contract,
yeah.
Which, you know, there's not a lot to it. But when she decided that I was doing well enough and she offered me a hardcover, we actually negotiated that contract over, I don't know, a few weeks, couple weeks, back and forth, what I was comfortable with, where, you know, what I wanted to see and what she needed to see. And fortunately, I trust my publisher. You know, she's been really good to me. She hasn't steered me wrong. But I actually have two different contracts, and my payouts are actually different. I'm getting a hardcover after the first of the year. The three mm-hmm. books should be coming out in a hardcover. And that's a completely different contract, a different payout. So I guess my thought is you could probably negotiate anything that you could live with.
Well, I think you had an advantage that a lot of people don't, because approaching like maybe a self-publishing company like CreateSpace or Equilibris or Lulu, or even going to one of the conventional publishers, you had a very close, intimate relationship with the person that you were negotiating a contract with. And one of the things that I found with a very, very large companies, whether it's self-publishing or not, they don't negotiate a contract. It's a boilerplate contract. If you don't like something on the contract, then you don't sign the contract and you don't proceed. So the ability you had to sit down with somebody over a cup of tea and talk about it is really ideal. Not too many people have that relationship, because she said she was a smaller publisher, correct?
Right. She's a smaller publisher, yeah. She's out of Canada.
Right. So she
and like I said, I don't know how many books she's published, but she's not like, you know, she's not like HarperCollins.
You know, like I am on my contract with my second book, Loveabouts with Tate, there was nothing on the contract that was negotiable, because it's boilerplate, because they're a big company. This is how it is. It's kind of like signing a mortgage, really. You don't really have much say in the terms, and if you don't like the terms, you don't get the mortgage. Well, you know, you don't get the book contract. That's how larger companies work, and there's an advantage right there that Annie talked about of having a smaller publisher, if you can get in, because you can sit down and talk to somebody. You're not dealing with a huge corporate entity.
Oh, yeah, because I get emails from her on occasion, and if I need help with something, because I've marketed my book hard,
right.
And if something isn't working for me, you know, she kind of pushes me in the right direction, and I can get advice from her. I've had a really good experience.
Everybody's going to be calling her for work, because that is an advantage. But that's not, from my understanding, what most people's experience is with a publisher. It's certainly a lot mm-hmm. more impersonal than what you've been able to enjoy. So that's great for you mm-hmm. that you've been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Annie,
so
you're talking about
hardcovers.
Yeah, you're talking about hardcovers. Can you explain the difference between the different covers and why hardcovers is a different dimension, it sounds like?
You want to take that? For me, it's just that my book has done well enough that I sort of earned it.
Okay.
What happens is paperbacks are cheaper for publishers to publish, whether it's conventional or non-conventional. And Annie put it very well. She earned the right to have a hard copy because that means the publisher is going to put more money into producing her book. It took 2 years before I was able to have the privilege of having my book published in hard copy because people don't buy hard copies a lot anymore.
Right.
So it's,
right.
You know, you there's an expression in the industry, Annie's book has legs now, which means it sold enough copies that they're saying, okay, this woman has got a wonderful product, she's working hard to market it, we're going to do this in hardcover now because we know that the risk we're taking financially most likely will be returned for both the author and the publisher.
Wow. Mm. Very cool, Annie.
I know.
I know. That's
I'm
great.
Very
now,
proud.
How is? Yeah, you should be. How is Kindle affected the way people market books?
I heard an interesting statistic just 3 days ago that for every 100 paperbacks that are sold, their hard copy, 115 download Kindles are sold, and that number seems to be on the increase. So you can probably extrapolate from that and say that more and more people are downloading their books rather than purchasing them.
That's how I get most of my books now is Kindle.
Well, you know, well, Nell and I talked about this before, that I just finished graduate school in 2007, and one of the projects I worked on was they weren't even calling them Kindles. They were calling them books on demand.
Right.
And we did a project on that, and what we had actually come to was, and if you look around at what the kids are doing, they do everything on their iPods or their phones. We had pretty much come to, you weren't going to be buying hard books anymore. And one of the things my publisher has and I talked about was she thinks that in the future books will be something that are a work of art.
Well,
your everyday books are going to be a download.
Yeah, I have a foot in both camps. I love my Kindle, but I also love having my books on my shelf. I like picking them up. I like turning the pages. And maybe the whole part just thinks that books will never really completely go away.
I have a wall.
No.
So a woman after my heart. I have mixed feelings about the books on demand and the you know, the downloading from computers, and I understand that great wonderful authors like Stephen King have gone to electronic media to publish his books because of the profit margin involved. But I'm in total agreement. You know, Annie, I get your book. I want to hold that book in my hand. I really do. There's nothing like holding a book and turning the pages. So you are my hero.
You know, David, what's amazing to me is, I mean, obviously everybody who's buying my book is buying it as a download. And I'm still hearing from them after they read it. They want the hardcover. They want me to sign it for them. They want the hardcover.
Yeah. So I've spent more money on books because I have Kindle, because I've gone and bought hardcovers after I've, or, you know, soft covers after I've read a book that I really enjoy. And I have
it's true.
People out there doing that.
Sometimes you just want to touch it and keep it, and, you know.
So and the photos and all the different stuff, you don't get that as much with the Kindle. So it is not, it's not as personal.
That's right.
I think it has its place.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Definitely.
I do want to throw this in, too. Now, Nell has read a lot of my poetry. I'm a cheater. Okay. I'm not a cheater. But as try to watch it now. I caught that. I'm it's hard to describe myself. I'm an activist. And there are many, many issues that I deal with, including issues such as the one that we're covering right now. I have a really strong heart and a really strong drive to speak out for my awesome fellow warriors who have survived years of abuse. I fight hard for animals and for the trees and waters and birds and of course, you know, being a native man, I do a lot of writing. I'm a free verse poet, and all that means is I'm not a poet. I just write down words. But
I've seen your YouTube, David. You're a poet.
I was gonna say this sounds like a poet to me.
Thank you. But you're one of the people, and Mary Beth, you're now entering the door of many people who inspire me. You know, to get the voice out, and it's an amazing process to do this. It is a healing process. I find healing. I mean, I don't want to go into details about my own life experiences, but a lot of what I write is based on the ideas that you're bringing forth. It's a catharsis for me when I see somebody going through all kinds of things, and I have wonderful friends who I call relatives in all parts of the world now. Nell and I, we share a lot of the same people in our networks, and I'm proud to say that Nell and I are in the same network. I'm really proud of this awesome woman. She does a great job getting together. It's inspiring that people can have. There are a lot of challenges to writing one story, and I'm sure that it's very difficult. I think you covered something to the effect, Annie, that it is difficult to organize your thoughts, and it's difficult to get all the details straight, the timing, the dates and events and when they happened, where they happened, and it's a very tough process. Do you have any word of advice for anyone out there who has experienced these traumas in regards to you know, how to get their thoughts down on paper, how to organize it? What can they do? I know what I do. I cheat. You know, I do free verse poetry. But you know,
I don't know. Maybe
Beth,
I cheat. I write a lot of little.
I don't know. But you know, both Annie and Mary Beth, you know, if you have any word of advice for anybody as far as like organizing the thoughts, what would you have to say?
Well,
I write a lot of little stories and call them essays, and then I put them in order because I can't. You don't remember your life in order. You remember your life randomly. But for the cohesiveness of my story, I need them to be in order. I can't be 5 and then 17.
Right.
So for me, I mean, that's how I do it. I write a lot of short stories, and then I put them together.
You know, I think for people who aren't writers, I use a method that I named backfilling. And if anybody wants to contact me, I'd be happy to send them the rules of backfilling to help you write. And basically it's starting out with just jotting down words, thoughts, phrases, and then slowly adding more meat to them. And it's almost like putting flesh on a skeleton. And for people who aren't naturally writers, who can't sit down and maybe write a couple paragraphs, this seems to work very well for them because it's a very technical, almost a surgical approach to putting thoughts down in paper, because you can put one word down, then you add 4, then you add 7, and then you add 10, and then you have a sentence. And it seems to work well for people. And if anybody contacts me, I'm happy to send them the instructions to backfilling. It might help them out.
I'd like to have them.
You absolutely. I find myself using it from time to time.
Well, I do. Right. You know, sometimes when I can't, and I just sit down and I feel like I can't write, I just start typing words, just mumbo jumbo words, and until something strikes me.
But sometimes just the process of things moving works.
If
that's interesting, because you know Stephen King uses that. And I, once again, I like referring to Stephen King because he is one of my favorite authors. He covers human personality so well. The, you know, all the loons and the and the people who hurt people just because it's fun to them. You know, he so that's what he does. He writes down certain key words and then he stores them away. And then when an idea comes in, he starts building around it. That I think that's a brilliant idea.
Well,
I didn't know he did that.
Oh yeah, Steve King and I were very close. Not, I
yeah.
Just
well,
his,
see,
I
when I have dinner with him, I'll tell him that.
You know what the advantage? If somebody's telling their own story, the advantage they have over somebody who has to write stories like Stephen King does is that their story is real. And if you take some comfort as a writer in knowing that you don't have to make anything up, that your story has already happened, it gives you a little bit of relief from, oh, I have to come up with something. Well, no, you really don't. It's already happened. It's already occurred. It's nonfiction. That's a method of backfilling. You just work from the facts, and you fill in, and you find that the story gets longer and longer and more complete and more cohesive. So starting with simple facts is a good way to begin.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yep. Yeah.
Well, what I'm going to do before we move on is we're going to take a little break, and then we'll come back and we'll start talking more about the publishing piece of it and marketing and all that.
Awesome.
All right?
All right.
Okay.
Stay tuned, guys.
Lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been, and now I got to where I am. But these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them. I was made for you. I climbed across the mountain top, swam all across the ocean blue. I crossed over.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome. Quiet Talk State Group. This is Dave Little Eagle. I'm your host for this edition of Stage Left with my co-host and producer, Nell Cole. If anybody's just tuning in, we have two wonderful, wonderful ladies on the show tonight who are helping others in the process of telling their story in writing a book. Anybody who's been through abuse and trauma, the best way to do it is by letting everybody know in written word, writing a book. It's a good idea. It's a great idea. And with us we have Annie O'Sullivan, who is author. Actually, there are three parts, but at least for now we have Can You Hear Me Now? And Can You Hear Me Now? Part 2. And we have Mary Beth Egling with us, who is guiding us in the process of writing and editing the stories and publishing. So welcome back to the show. And ladies, please continue.
Hi. So what I'd like to do before we continue is make sure if there's anything, Annie, that you've heard so far that you would like to add anything to?
No. I've learned a couple of things, which is always good.
Yeah. Right. I just want to make sure before we move forward there wasn't anything that you wanted to add. What about you, Mary Beth? Was there anything that you think we overlooked that we needed to...
No, not overlooked. I just think I want to emphasize what I think everybody said so far is that the pain of writing a story is very difficult to face. It's difficult to contend with. It's difficult to stand there and stare it in the eye. But the catharsis that you receive after you write your story down is far more valuable than the difficulty you have to go through to get to that point where you can look back
right.
on it.
Right on.
Mm-hmm. That takes a
right.
lot of courage, but you will feel better on the other side. There's absolutely no doubt about it. I've never met anybody who has felt worse, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. That's
true.
So, don't let your editor hurt your feelings. They're doing it for your own good.
Yeah,
that's right.
That is a good one. Mm-hmm. All right, so now I think the next phase, unless I'm wrong, is the marketing. Do you think we've covered everything in publishing too, or do you think we should start there in marketing, Mary Beth?
Well, I'm more of a knowing the process before marketing. It's kind of like thinking about, you know, what your baby's going to be when they grow up when they're not born yet. But certainly
right.
marketing is a big part of any thought process if, in fact, someone does decide to publish a book. I mean, there's so many nuances we could talk about this evening, so I think there's certainly a value in talking about marketing, for example.
All right, so why don't you guide us through different choices in marketing that people may have?
Well, there's free marketing, which is what I think everybody prefers. You know, there's Facebook,
yeah.
there's... Twitter, there's, you can blog about your book, you can go to your friends and family and friends of friends and family and people you knew in first grade, and, you know, I'm sure Annie has been through all of those processes because it's an internal network that you can kind of tap, if you will, and help you spread news.
You start with that and you build a base and then you just keep trying to grow, but you got to keep at it.
You do. And it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. There's just no two ways about it. And there aren't a whole lot of people that I know that have a huge marketing budget, for example. If they can get a website built, that's really more than a lot of people can handle sometimes. So I think, especially when you're starting out, and especially if it's your first book, just utilizing all of the free options you have in front of you. And there really are more than people think there are.
So you found Facebook?
Oh, there's Facebook and Twitter and StumbleUpon and, just about anything you can think of. But there's a
social media named after it. They're all free.
Right.
You need to. I believe that you need to get on them. I also actually, I can't remember the name of the company, but I ended up with 1,000 postcards for my first book. It cost me $100, and they were glossy. And I handed them out to my friends and had them mail this, like, announcement out. And I still have some. Whenever I travel, I leave them in hotel rooms, and I just kind of litter the planet with them. But you don't know where that goes. So
you don't.
You kind of have to be like a Johnny
Gaffney. Now, that Vistaprint is a good one for that kind of stuff. You can get a ton of stuff on that for next to nothing.
Well, the other thing I found, too, with marketing a book is that you may not know where your market is really going to be. And sometimes just putting it out there, the opportunities have a tendency to find you rather than you finding them.
Right.
That's true.
You know, that's the magic of
the That's so true, because the people I was writing for are not the people who I'm getting a lot of support from.
Exactly. You know, we can't presume to know, and I think the biggest... I guess the biggest, in my sense, the biggest overall sense of marketing is don't say no to anything and say yes to everything. You know, if it looks like you can talk about your book, if it looks like you have an opportunity to leave, like you said, a postcard in a hotel, you have to be a Johnny Appleseed with your story. And maybe you know, a small percentage of the things that you have done will result in a book sale, but then that's okay because... the message got to somebody.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as having to run websites and all that, what has happened with both of you as far as that piece of it? Because that becomes its own little community from the readers. So can you speak to me about the experience you've both had with your readers?
Why don't you go first, Annie, because your story is a lot more personal than mine, certainly.
I have, I'm approaching 4,000 people on Facebook now. And but what has happened for me is I'm hearing from people and they're telling me their story when they've never told anybody. And they will come, they'll come and tell me, and I take that very seriously. It's very sacred that they're telling me their biggest secret, because they think I understand. They believe that I understand, and I think that the other side of that is I do answer them and I do take the time, and they become very loyal and they pass the word for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You have to take your readers. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I'm like the boss of the world, but the way I feel is I have to take my readers very seriously, because this is really serious information. And if they fought enough to sit down and write me, I think that I have an obligation, a moral obligation, to sit down and write them back. And I'm happy to do that. I wouldn't want anybody to think for one minute that I'm not. Because I'm flattered, actually, that they have that kind of connection, that they can talk to me. I don't know that I would get that if I was, you know, Stephen King. It feels very sacred to me.
Well,
and I don't know how else to explain it.
That's a good way to put it.
And that's a reflection on you and who you are as a person in this world. Because
Absolutely.
Some people would be indifferent. So I appreciate the fact that you do find that sacred. And I'm sure the people that are sharing their story do as well.
Right.
Well, thanks. I don't think I actually ever said that out loud before.
Well, Mary Beth,
I'm sitting here thinking,
your book,
no.
Mary Beth, when you sent your book, it came in a little bag and had a little heart. I mean, it was beautifully packaged, the whole thing. Is there a lot of different choices like that in how
well, you know,
you put
I
your book together?
Echoing, Just echoing on Annie's comments, whenever I get an order from somebody I don't know from PayPal or from Amazon, I write them a little note on the receipt telling them thank you and how much I appreciate. And one thing I love about you is that you bought my book. I do
yeah.
those gift bags with a little heart on them because, you know, my interaction with the people who purchased my two books is not as difficult probably as some of the people that might contact Annie. Some of it, I have a lot more celebratory type of responses,
yeah.
but I don't take their comments any less seriously. I absolutely have to agree with Annie. I answer every email. If somebody writes me a letter, I write them a letter back. And I think that
awesome.
That shows a level of commitment to yourself and to your message as well as to the people that are your readership. And I would hate for it to get to the point where I could never do that anymore because that, to mm-hmm. me, is one of the most important things that has happened since I have put my two books out there.
Right on.
Yeah.
Don't you think it's respect for your readers?
It is, and for yourself and your work. And I think the important thing that I did not hear in your conversation or mine was discussion of money, because it's nice to make money. It's wonderful to be able to make a living selling books, but the primary reason is a connection, whether it's a connection over something traumatic, whether it's a connection over something positive. If
right.
you are that sincere about your message, abundance will always follow you because of how committed you are to yourself, to your work, and to the people who privilege you by purchasing it. That's how I see it. The triad is very important.
Oh,
beautifully
I
said.
Agree.
Beautifully said.
Absolutely. So, other than you two ladies being absolutely amazing, and I'm so beyond thrilled to have you on the show, because the information and the warmth within your spirit is really going to help people find the strength they need to tell their story. So thank you both so much for coming on this show.
Thank you.
Oh. Now, as far as the marketing piece, what else? Is there anything else toward that you feel people need to know?
Well, you know, I think that you don't have to spend a lot of money. I don't know, you know, maybe Annie would agree, in order to get your word out. You can spend a lot of money. I just don't think that absolutely should discourage anybody from the end point of, oh, sure, I have a book now. How am I going to promote it? Because you don't have
you
to
can.
Have a large budget to do that.
Oh, I agree. I haven't spent a lot of money because I have a lot of money to spend.
Right.
But I do everything that's free. If
mm-hmm.
it's free, I'm there.
That's right.
And you just never turn down an opportunity. And they come from, you know, all over the place, actually. But, yeah, you don't have to spend a lot of money. There's one company in particular I looked at last month, and for everything that I already figured out on my own, they would charge $10,000.
That's right.
To put that together for you. And you don't have to do that.
And there's no guarantee either. You know, with companies that there's no guarantee with most marketing companies you sign on, you pay a minimum fee, and there's no guarantee that you're going to sell X number of books or have a certain you know, percentage of points up on Google. It's all really kind of a crapshoot in a way. And the best way to handle
oh, right.
it is what you said. Anything you can do that's free, and there's hundreds of things you can do to promote your book to people without spending very much money at all. I came up with a kind
right.
of sneaky way. I donate my books to libraries, and in the back I put a stamp that says, for a signed copy of this book, please visit my website.
Nice.
And
oh,
I have
oh
gotten
good
people,
idea.
So try it. Go ahead, take it. Use it. It is they're doing something nice for the community, you know, and I've often told people, if you can't afford to buy my book, that the library has it. Please feel free to check it out. So I also
mm-hmm.
look at, you know, donating to churches, donating to women's shelters. You know, 30
mm-hmm.
books that you end up donating does a lot of good and then some. So
right.
I always tell people one of the marketing things you can do is give from your abundance.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And then it comes back to you.
It always does.
Well, it does.
Yeah.
Now,
that's very good.
There's a question that comes to my mind, and I don't know exactly why I have to bring this up, but marketing can be very difficult. Self-promotion it can be very difficult. And, you know, what can we tell potential authors that are out to write their stories and to borrow Mel's phrase, to speak their truth in a book? There are a lot of emotional factors and spiritual factors involved in marketing and self-promotion. It's not easy for everybody. It can be very difficult. As a matter of fact, I think in many cases, to borrow a phrase from the psychological community, can be a trigger. It's difficult. Because what do these authors, what do these precious people tell the public that they encounter when they speak at churches or speak at libraries or speak at any events where they're introducing their book? You know, what can we tell these awesome people when suddenly, you know, what they're telling people essentially about themselves? So, you know, I can almost see triggers being pulled left and right for many of these people. Now, we're not, none of us, and this is a disclaimer, none of us are licensed psychologists. We're not licensed counselors. We're not doctors of psychology or psychiatry. As a matter of fact, I don't like psychiatrists for the most part. I'm sorry, I had to throw that in now. but you know, we don't have any, we're not professionals in this, but as writers and as published authors, what advice can you give for these awesome people that want to tell their story in a book? Because it's not easy for everybody.
My book, if you go to buy it, it doesn't matter. If you go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you go, there's actually a statement on there that this is very graphic material. My Facebook page has a list of books, and in that document it's separated that the books on this list may cause triggers for people. And it's important that you put that out there, because everyone is not prepared to read your story.
Right.
I think that's really important. I have a really good friend, and she wants to be loyal and read my book. She tells me this all the time. I really want to read it, and she feels guilty that she's not reading it, but she's afraid to. Mm. And I tell her, don't read it. You know, you don't have to read it. You know who I am. You know, I don't need that kind of loyalty. But I think that when you, some people have stories that if you're going to sit down and you're going to read it, you need to be prepared.
Well, I think what I'm talking about is a reader content fit, and that's so important, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you've done what you need to do to put almost a disclaimer on. With my books, I say Love Abouts is for everybody, and Messages from My Hands is not for everybody. As a matter of fact, my mother did not even finish my first book because it was difficult for her to do so. So I think recognizing that your book is only going to fit, you meaning a potential author, is only going to fit in certain places helps you not only accept that it's not going to fit everywhere, but it kind of directs you toward the avenues you can freely express or read or present on it.
Right.
And it doesn't mean you can't talk about it. It doesn't mean that people don't want to hear what you have to say. It doesn't even mean that they don't want to hear your story. They're not prepared to hear. They need a I can't think of the word, but they need a softer version.
Mm-hmm. And some people need filters, you know, for
filters.
Life events, they need filters. And I think as an author, it's important to try and identify those different tiers in your readership in as much as you can. It's virtually impossible to do it totally accurately, but I think, especially if you're having a conversation with somebody, you have an idea whether they can, quote-unquote, handle your book or not.
Right.
But again, that should never be a reason for someone not to write a story, obviously. You find your readership once your story is told, not the other way around.
Right.
So write your truth, and then your readers will come.
That's right.
Absolutely. It's a disturbing thing that I observed, however. And you know, they say that truth is oftentimes stranger than fiction. And what bothers me is that we live in a society that can watch bombings, they can watch murders,
mm-hmm.
they can watch rapes and violations of every kind in a fictional movie and go, oh, wow, that was a good movie, a lot of action. But they're so disturbed about the truth, the nonfiction of violence, of rape and violation of every kind. It really irks the crap out of me, honestly. You know, that we live in that kind of society.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You're right. We watch things that I think people are, you know, in my opinion, I think, you know, I watch this stuff on TV and I think, you know, we're going to be desensitized to all this stuff. But then
exactly.
you do put out there something that really happened, and you're right. They're like, oh, you know, I can't see that.
Uh-huh.
Well, there's a lot of comfort for people in knowing that it's not real. And
right.
there's a lot of
right.
comfort in knowing that it actually happened. And that's part of the human mind that it's a very difficult thing to get around, but it's a reality.
Yeah.
If we know something really didn't happen, we can watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I'd like to do now, if y'all don't mind, is move on to how you get paid and how to maximize your profit, I guess, on the books. So
it's magical.
Who would like to start on that? Magical profit, where the money just flows in like magic.
I've got 10 words. My publisher handles all of it. I don't really know how it works. She's got me in 200 or so online stores. She tracks all of that. And I just get a check every quarter for, you know, whatever I get. There's different for – I know that on mine, they're all of those contracts are negotiated. Some are a little better than others. But really all I do is I look at the bottom line at the end of the quarter, and my publisher's happy and I'm happy. But this is not where I make my money, my living either. So that's all I have on that subject.
I can give some industry standard insights if you'd like. Most publishers, either conventional or self-publishing, pay quarterly royalties. They are calculated over a 30-day period, and then 15 days after the 30-day period is over, you get a check in the mail. That's how it's done in the industry. With authors who sell their own books, you make a profit immediately. If I sell my book, Loveabouts, for the list price, you know, I take the money that I make minus what I paid the publisher to purchase my book, and that becomes my profit. And a good rule of thumb is the farther the book gets away from the author, the less money the author gets paid. For example,
mm-hmm.
if I sell my book, I make the most margin on it. If my publisher sells it from their website, I make a little less. If Amazon or Barnes & Noble sells it, I make a little bit less. If Sam
right.
Discount Books, I make a little bit less. So the farther
right.
the book gets away, the less the author makes.
That's
right.
true. I make almost three times as much if it's purchased through my publisher.
Right.
I do know that.
So it's basically a tier. The author, if you look at the author's central, is if you want to talk about profits, the author makes the most money. If, you know, I make my brother buy my book, I just made more money. If he buys it from the publisher's website, it's a little less, and it goes on and on from there. And again,
right.
at least with my experience and the people that have purchased books that I've known, it's a pretty boilerplate percentage off of the list price, and it gets reduced as it goes down the line. So it obviously
right.
behooves the author to be to sell a lot of books, because that's how you make the most money.
Mm.
And to echo
wow.
what Annie just said, I don't know any author that that's how they make all their money. I have a day job. Annie has a day job. All the other authors I know have day jobs because it's very difficult to make a living selling books,
right.
Just like it's difficult to make a living being a musician, for example.
Oh, hello.
Hello, Lucy.
Possible.
Hey, David, we thought you were just making bank over there.
My feathers just got ruffled. Thank you.
Oh, how funny. Yeah, it definitely isn't something that most people can do full time, although you end up working your job and then your websites and Facebook and emails and all the different things in between your job.
Yeah, I think I calculated that I make about 12 cents an hour with everything I do. You know, because really you spend many, many hours, especially initially, and you don't often get a fruitful response right away, but you can't let that discourage you because it does take time.
Mm-hmm.
There are very, very few people who their book hits the New York Times bestseller 2 weeks after it's been published.
Well,
the exception
you know what? People. You know what? If you're not Stephen King, who knows you're here?
That's right, especially if you're it's your first time. I mean, you have a trilogy working, Annie, so you have a name for yourself. You have readership.
Mm-hmm.
You've got people who follow you and who are anticipating something.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody just coming out of the gate, they're completely an unknown. They're at the bottom of the pile, and it's lonely down there, but you can't
mm-hmm.
just give up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know
so
I was talking to somebody, and I said, you know, I go to work all day, and I come home, and I go to work again. So
that's right.
That's right.
So you better love whatever you write. You better love it enough.
You
like it becomes a part of your entire life, and
mm-hmm.
love it like you would a spouse or a member of the family, because it does become a big piece of what you do on a daily basis, it sounds like.
It's one of the most satisfying things that I have ever done in my life to publish a book, and I know I'm not alone in that. There's something so, such a wonderful sense of internal achievement, and you're not looking for approval from anybody else. It's a sense of your
right.
own accomplishment that is really not even, for me, not even really quantifiable.
Right.
Yeah, I have to agree. You know, we said all these things that I wouldn't want anybody to be discouraged, because this
no.
has been a wildly satisfying accomplishment in my life.
Right.
And yeah, and it is what you make it, I guess.
Right.
How willing are you to work what needs to be worked to move the book and to develop the networks and all that? It's not an easy process, but it's definitely one that can be done if you're willing to show up every day and put in the time and effort to make it happen.
You know,
that's right.
If I add one thing now about the difficulty of it, in talking about any book you're starting to write, there are always going to be people who are going to give you cautions, and they're going to say, well, maybe you should do this, and this is not a good idea. And you really
mm-hmm.
have to make up your mind right away to put your hand up and say, are you going to help me or are you going to harm me? Because
right.
you really have to
right.
only allow people who genuinely want your success and want to support you, because there's enough doubt and enough agonizing things you're going to go through having naysayers and negative people in your space when you're doing such a difficult thing is really
right.
is just so self-defeating.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What
yeah.
about audiobooks and using your own voice and stuff for that? I know, Annie, aren't you considering doing an audio?
I would love to do audio. I hadn't really thought about it. Last summer I was approached by a company, and my gut feeling was just not there. I just something was not right, and I just went with that. Ultimately, I didn't do it, but it got me thinking about it, and. Well, you've heard me read. That was the first time I'd ever done that. But
it was fantastic.
Want to do an audio, but I don't know where to begin. So
my publisher did an audio book for Loveabouts, and I had the option of flying to Oklahoma and being in the facility for 2 weeks recording. And because it would have to be all at my expense, obviously. And because
right.
the money was not there and I couldn't take time away from my family and from work, I chose the second option, which is having a professional reader narrate my book. And essentially what happens is they give you three choices of readers, and then you can pick the voice that you think you would like your book read in. And then they do the recording. And you can do that independent of a publishing house or as part of a publishing package, whether it's conventional or self-published. So that there is certainly a way to get that done. It's a question of whether or not you want to do the voice.
I think for me it's important
that I do my own voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is extremely important for you to do your own voice, and I'm going to fuss at you if you don't, because the inflection...
Nell's my cheerleader.
I am. Because the tones and everything of a moment, a person who didn't live it can't know the
That's
harshness
right.
in one person's voice or the subtlety or the frailty, the vulnerability of something. All that has to be lived so that that inflection comes through your voice. And
Absolutely.
You are the only one that can understand where to put what in your story, Annie.
Mm-hmm.
So you definitely have to.
That's on the burner.
I got to finish part three first.
All right. Well, hurry up. We're waiting. I don't want to rush you or anything, but we're waiting.
No pressure. No pressure.
While
not
calling you and giving you plenty of space to work at your own time, but we're just waiting outside the door for you to hurry up.
Yeah, I hear the irony in your voice now.
All right, before we wrap everything up, Annie, is there anything else you would like to add to everything that's happened tonight?
Probably just the same thing I always do is I just, everybody's got a story, you know, and don't be afraid to tell it. There's a lot of people out there that need to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just so worth it. The experience is so worth it.
That's right.
And can you give us your web page again?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
www.writersportal.org/can-you-hear-me-now. And you can find me on Facebook at Annie O'Sullivan 2009.
Fantastic.
Wonderful.
And what about you, Mary Beth?
I think that I would like to say to anybody listening that is on the precipice of finding the courage to write their book, that if you come up with a reason why you can't, call me and I will give you 10 why you can't.
Oh, love it. Absolutely
Good.
Can do this. And there are more people out there on the other side of having told their story, but there's more people than that behind you that don't even have the courage to think about telling it. And by you taking the time and the effort and the energy to tell your story, you are going to free more people than you have any idea. So it's imperative and critical that if you're thinking about doing it, just make the decision to do it and bring it forward.
Right.
Just get moving. The rest will come.
That's right.
Can you share your contact information one more time with our listeners, Mary Beth, please?
Sure. My website is www.mbegling.com, and my Facebook page is MB Egling, spelled the same way. And my phone number is 585-544-2106. If you'd rather talk in person, I can do that too.
Very kind of you indeed. David, is there anything within the show?
Well, I was going to give the penultimate word to you now, because there is a closing statement that I'd like to put out to our listeners. So do you have anything to add to this awesome conversation that we've had tonight?
Well, it's kind of hard with this big grin on my face to really. I'm just so beyond happy to have these strong ladies here, and they laid it out as beautifully as you could lay it out and as warm as you can lay it out, and I deeply thank them for that, because this is an important piece of helping these survivors get their truth out. So thank you so much, ladies. And I turn it over to you, David.
Well, this is what I have to say to you, my friends, listening, and I think to you, Annie, and to you, Mary Beth, and to you, Nell, my very dear friends here. I'm a musician, and I compose my own music. There have been times when I've done performances, and there would be no applause at the end of the song. But instead, as I would look into the audience, there would be sniffles, and there would be tears. And somebody would approach me after a performance and would say to me, "Dave, I really needed that."
Yep.
So if anybody out there has a story to tell, you've been through a lot of pain and a lot of sorrow, a lot of suffering, you may not get a lot of applause, but you're going to hear the sniffles and you're going to see the tears run. And those tears are going to be tears of healing. So I encourage you, you want to write your story, you can do it. And to our listeners, you know, we love you. We thank you for joining us for this edition of Fire Talk, Stage Left. I want to thank Annie for being with us tonight, and Mary Beth, you ladies are absolutely wonderful. Nell, thank you again for doing such a wonderful job, as always.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, I wish you a good night. Walk in peace, walk in beauty, and be good to one another. Aho.
David, before you run off, would you mind gifting us with a song?
I would be honored, no.
We would, too. Thank you so much, David. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
I've been holding on to a secret, the deep, dark kind that you keep inside. All of my life, I've been so mixed up, tried to run. Every day when I look in the mirror, I can't believe all the faces I see. I feel stained and I feel dirty, but soap and water never washed me clean. No, this is not my imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you Sometimes it's too hard to remember. Oh, the memory is killing me. How could someone say they love you and take away the child in me? Every day when I look in the mirror, I can't believe that it's happened to me. I've been hurt and I feel cheated. It's time I finally set me free. No, this is not my imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you hear is a true confession of a deep, dark secret that's been haunting me. Your imagination. No, this is not just a very bad dream. What you have.